Welcome to the Get Star Brazilian podcast. I'm Gar O'Hara. Today we have Lee Robig, customer CISO for Securo, joining us. Lee comes to his current role having been on the other side of the table. He's done the work of securing organizations as a practitioner, having built and led cybersecurity strategy, architecture, security teams, and end-to-end security programs in large enterprises across the APAC region. These days, he helps Securo's clients with cybersecurity strategy, architecture, exec advisory, zero trust, and its associated technologies. We talk through what ZT really is, lesser thought of benefits, how ZT aligns with other well-known frameworks, what type of orgs ZT works for, and we round out with Lee's advice for pursuing a ZT strategy. Over to the conversation. Welcome to the Get Star Brazilian podcast. I'm Gar O'Hara, and today I'm joined by Lee Robig, who is the customer CISO for Securo. How are you doing today, Lee?
Going good, thanks, Gar. Thanks for having me on.
Absolute pleasure. We got to speak, it's a couple of months ago now, and there was a very obvious sense of excitement about the work you're doing in Zero Trust, and luckily we were able to kind of line this up to have the conversation, so thanks so much for joining us today.
No worries.
So, the first question we pretty much ask everybody is, how did you get to where you are today? I think it's a useful one just so people can understand your perspective and how you've arrived to be somebody that, you know, we should all listen to.
Yeah, okay. It's a good question. So, I'm the customer CISO for Securo, as you mentioned. Bit of a strange title, so I can probably explain what that means first. So, I help our clients directly with cybersecurity strategy, risk advisory, and any associated technologies to help them on their cybersecurity roadmap as well. Also, our internal SME around Zero Trust as well. I've consulted on numerous Zero Trust strategies for a lot of different industries in Australia, so health, insurance, banking, construction, manufacturing, and multiple ASX-listed companies as well. In terms of how I got here, I've spent the majority of my career on, I guess you'd say, the non-consultancy side of the fence, so the customer side, I like to call it, where I've been in technology and cybersecurity and also leadership roles for around 16 years. And in terms of how I got here, so I had finished up a gig as the head of information security for a global organization in APAC. And I basically, at that time, kind of took a bit of a break and went, okay, what's next for me? At first I started going for similar roles to what I'd been doing. And then I got, I think it was approached by a recruiter, and they mentioned sort of there was a cybersecurity consultancy that was interested in someone like me. Sort of sat down and worked out, well, what do I love about my role? And what I loved the most about it was sort of by protecting an organization, you could potentially protect thousands of employees and millions of customers. And I think that's a very rewarding part of the role. And I figured that I can still get that satisfaction and even at a larger scale doing this in a consultancy fashion where I could do it for a lot of different organizations. So that's kind of how I landed where I am today. And yeah, I've been loving it. I'm a year into this now.
That's very cool. And bringing the kind of in the trenches experience, I think is going to be critical, right? In a role like that, where you've kind of lived and breathed it from the other side. So kind of know what it's like to be on the other side of the table. I suspect that helps a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it builds up a lot of rapport with any kind of clients or other peers in the industry that I speak to pretty much immediately, because we can trade war stories and we know that we're both battling the same battles to some extent, or we've been through the same battles.
Definitely. And Securo, it's kind of interesting watching that trajectory over the last kind of little while. I've seen many friends in the industry, through kind of how that organization came together from, you know, the subset of companies, very interesting play you guys are doing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So a lot of people may not know, but Securo is a kind of cybersecurity and digital transformation solutions provider. The main thing we do is help clients take a strategic approach to cybersecurity and risk mitigation, whilst also achieving digital transformation at the same time. The key thing with us is we're a merger of four companies that have come together and founder-owned led as well. And as a result, we've got like the best parts of these four different companies that have come together and formed Securo, allowing us to kind of, those four companies all did different things in terms of cybersecurity. So now we've got this well-experienced GRC team, technology and platforms teams, offensive security team, managed security services, and also team augmentation teams, so that we can kind of be there for that whole 360-degree journey that any client needs, Whereas in the past, a lot of these brands would have had to, they'd be able to help the client with some things, but have to hand off to a completely different partner or send them somewhere else. But now we can sort of help them end to end no matter what they need, which is quite good.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, Shaman Tan was one of the first people that was on the pod. I think she was like one of the, yeah, certainly the single digit episodes way back in the day. So good to kind of like continue the conversation with you guys, which is awesome. So what got you into Zero Trust?
Yeah, it was actually by accident. So So I headed up security for an organization for a number of years, and they were completely on-premise everything. 100% of every important asset or piece of data for the organization was inside the perimeter. So our security program matched that. Then I moved from that organization into another, in another cybersecurity leadership role. And I had this sudden rude awakening when I realized that there were no assets that were on-premise for this company. Users worked remotely all the time. There were no static IPs. There were no static domains. There were no standard operating environments and images for workstations and servers. There were no group policies and firewalls at every site. And this was all spread across about 5 countries as well. So I kind of, my old bag of tricks really wouldn't work anymore. So I kind of had to take a step back and thought, okay, I have to adapt my approach now. So I sort of did a bunch of research and came up with this plan on how we kind of protect the organization globally without reliance on, you know, networks, domains, and or direct access to things. And we sort of, it was a bit painstaking at the time because this was a reasonably new approach a number of years ago. But we found the technologies to match, you know, our plan and our cybersecurity program. So we started on this and worked through this with my team for over a year. And we'd had a lot of great success. And then at that time, even though Zero Trust has been around for a long time, Zero Trust really started to gain some traction and be talked about in a lot of different circles. So I went and looked into Zero Trust, as I would for any kind of buzzwords, and went, oh, actually, hey, that's what we've been doing. And so from that point forward, I was all in. I was like, okay, great. There is a name for this modern approach to security where you don't make those assumptions and rely on those internal networks and perimeters anymore. And so that was pretty much it, sort of by accident. But now I'm known as Mr. Zero Trust around the traps because I never stopped talking about it.
Good stuff. Look, it is a funny one in the industry, right? And I think, you know, the comment would be that in cyber, we tend to get excited about things and to use your word, like buzzwords, you know, it's amazing. Something comes out and it's in every brochure when you go to RSA or Black Hat, you know, everyone's got it, you know, AI, Zero Trust. And I think the thing I've observed is quite often they're really, really useful approaches, but we kind of get ahead of ourselves with the brochures and actually, you know, like to your point, these are sometimes things that have been around for quite some time, but actually we just, you know, haven't really spoken about, or there wasn't really a name or a label for it. What is, like, so Zero Trust, like, it's such a funny one because I've, you know, been on panels and I know you have too, and this is a conversation that many people have. What is it really? There's different flavors. Like, there's no definition, right, of Zero Trust. Like, for you, what is Zero Trust actually really all about?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there that everybody claims to know it or maybe have the answer to it and all that sort of thing. And it's a lot more than something that can be kind of easily summed up. I always say to people that if we need to boil it down to the most shortest possible one-sentence concept, I say, in quotes, it's a concept that no one and nothing has access until it's proven it should be trusted. And we have to take as much context into account when making that trust decision. But that's not terribly helpful. So what I go on to explain is that it's a lot more than that. It's also a mindset that should empower how we approach and think about security in our organizations, kind of both now and in the future, of course, as well. And it's overall a modern approach to security in a world where data, users, and devices are kind of no longer within our perimeter and controllable and reachable via direct network access at all times. If you go back and look at the old approach we took to security, where we had image computers with SOEs, file servers on sites, on-premise exchange, the analogy that's, you know, commonly used but very apt to explain it is an organization and assets were more like a castle. There was one bridge in or maybe two, i.e. Yep. the physical building or a VPN that you'd hand out sparingly. And then there was huge walls around anything of value inside. And for us cybersecurity teams and leaders, it was easier to stop an attacker because we knew there was only one or two places that they'd come in. I.e. if you're building secure and you hand out that VPN very sparingly or you configure it properly, then we've mitigated most of our external facing threats. So back then we invested in technologies and controls that made like one key assumption, we would have access to all these things at all times to be able to secure them. And at that time, the very thought that people could or would expect to be able to get up, walk out of the office and pick up where they left off was reasonably unheard of, except for maybe in the most cutting edge companies. But if you look at where we are now, and obviously the pandemic has accelerated this exponentially, which is why now everybody's talking about it. Companies have used technology to enable unparalleled productivity, in my view. And they've gained a lot of strong kind of business value from that, but a lot of risk exposure as a side effect. So now the analogy like I used to explain what an organization typically looks like now is more like a skyscraper part of a city rather than that castle with walls around it. And the reason we say that is because like a city, there's so much activity everywhere now that it's hard to distinguish what's a threat and what is innocent. There's multiple ways in and out of our skyscraper from all directions. And lastly, our information is stored in many surrounding buildings out of our control, where it's difficult for us to just look at their building from outside and go, yes, that seems secure, but if I'm not in there, I don't really know how secure the inside of that building is. And what that is really a big analogy for is that email and file storage are available everywhere now. Most of our critical data is now hosted by third parties, accessible in a browser from anywhere in the world. Portable devices as well are now, like we're talking laptops, phones, tablets, are now the norm rather than the exception. I remember it wasn't too long ago where execs and IT were the only people who got nice portable laptops. And now I don't know any employee that doesn't get a laptop on day one. And employees as well expect to be able to work from anywhere, anytime. And even us in the cybersecurity teams, the most risk-averse people in an organization are using that for talent acquisition, right? It's hard to hire people at the moment. So we're going, you can work from anywhere you like. You can work from another country. You don't have to be in the same capital city as the head office now. So basically, with all of that, to reiterate, the main issue is that our security controls relied on that assumption. Everything important was at arm's length. And thus, our kind of security controls only had arm's reach too. So what I'm talking about there in practical terms is we relied on a lot of proxies and hardware and network filtering and antivirus and group policies that only really worked when users were on-premise and assets were on-premise.
Yep.
Now when people venture outside that reach, these things either get very limited protection and visibility, and in some cases they get none at all. And that used to sort of be our main security nightmare, and particularly the pandemic really accelerated this. But technology started coming along over the years that recognized that, probably before we started to talk a lot about zero trust so much. And these technologies allow that kind of secure anywhere in the world type approach using kind of cloud-based security technologies. And then that's when zero trust really gained its time to shine, I think.
Definitely. So you mentioned a word there, which I'm obsessed with at the moment, which is context. And you know, the idea of zero trust to me, a big part of it is, as you said, it's context. It's, you know, what is in this moment going on for this particular user or this, even a device, you know, depending on what we're talking about. What are some of the contextual things that, you know, an organization like you guys would be looking at feeding in to make those decisions around in that moment, you know, just in time, permissions, or, you know, is this okay to do or not, as the case may be? What do you think are like is there a laundry list of the best things you can use to inform that decision in the moment?
Yeah, I would say we used to rely on username and passwords, and it was long proven before zero trust came about that that's not sufficient anymore, right? So
yeah,
then definitely. We added multi-factor on top, but then we went the path of least resistance, and we went down the what's the easiest thing we can roll out to users, and we usually kind of leaned on SMS. Now SIM swapping attacks are a thing, but they're not quite as commonplace. But how much time have we got until they become very commonplace and we start to have concerns around that or other weaknesses are found in that? So I believe as well that when a user connects to a system, both externally and also internally, that we need to take into account the device they're connecting from. Is this a corporate device? Is this a BYOD type device? And treat their access differently depending on that. We also need to look at the location they're connecting from. Just because they're on a company device, if they're connecting from somewhere that they've never connected from before, or that, you know, what we call impossible travel. They've connected from Brisbane today and Los Angeles in a few hours. That's faster than Superman. They need to be Superman to get there that fast, right? So we treat those as differently, and sometimes we would deny them altogether. And those are the kind of contexts that you take into account, I believe. So what the user's accessing, what level of a multi-factor they've passed in terms of its security, what device they're connecting from, and also is that device actually in compliance? And so you can get a lot of other tools and systems to talk to your identity system or whatever you're using to make a decision on whether that user should be granted access or not.
Definitely. And I love the idea of, you know, the device in compliance or not. And I was speaking to somebody a couple of weeks ago who had a very elegant approach, which was literally denying network access if a device, and in that case, we're talking about laptops, fell out of compliance because people weren't rebooting laptops. And I know many of my colleagues here, you know, can be guilty of that thing where, you know, they joke about how long their laptop has been up without a reboot. And yeah, this person was saying that they sort of push out a toast or pop up on the machine and say, hey, you've got basically today, and then tomorrow your machine is getting rebooted or you're losing network access, take your pick sort of thing. And they've seen the kind of drop off rate for non-compliant devices, just being kind of impressive. So yeah, very cool. Look, the way you're talking, Lee, and you know, I think it's kind of fairly well understood, we're not talking about products here, right? You kind of mentioned you built that this is a strategy pre the terminology zero trust, but it sounded like you went and looked for sort of technical control solutions to build out what you saw as a solid way to kind of protect the organization. Like what's your thinking there in terms of zero trust? Like we're not talking about product, right? You can't go buy zero trust.
That's right. Yeah, it definitely isn't a product. And this is a conversation I have quite often with people. And even people who admit or agree that it's not a product, they think it's just a few products that they need to buy. So they think maybe I'll just get like a good identity system and I'll do some network segmentation. Then I've achieved zero trust, right? And I have to keep sort of reminding people that it definitely isn't. So, and I don't actually blame people for having that misconception as well, because I think ZT as a term, it's unfortunately been used enough in the market that cybersecurity practitioners have grown tired of hearing about it, believing it to be just another buzzword, as you said, Gar, or marketing fluff or something along those lines, which I think is a shame, because if an organization fully understands it and embraces it, it will actually pay really strong dividends for any organization for years to come. And it'll kind of, in a way, I mean, I hate to say the word future-proof, but it's the best thing I can think of to explain it. It'll future-proof the security program a lot better than some of our security approaches of old. But to be clear as well, I mean, you can't really achieve a lot of the controls you need to without some technology to help you, right? But that's always been the case. This isn't like a new thing with zero trust. It's any kind of cybersecurity program. It's going to be pretty difficult without controls, technologies to back you up. So what I'll say here is that many vendors' technologies will give you alignment with parts of an overall zero trust strategy, but none can do it all end to end. And to get people thinking in the right frame of mind, what the kind of, I don't know if you call it an analogy, but what I kind of bring to the forefront of their mind is all security technology has always claimed to secure our organization, right? But we all know automatically that, of course, my organization is not going to be secure because I bought that one technology that said it would secure my organization. Just apply that same thinking you've always had for that kind of thing to zero trust, and you'll remember every time.
Yep. Yeah, really good point. So like I've heard it described, and I think you actually even used the words earlier, but it's a philosophy, it's an approach rather than a product or even a set of products. Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about the security side of this, and that's obviously a very strong outcome here. But what else? I mean, presumably this kind of approach is going to give you more than just security.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and that's actually it's my favorite thing about zero trust. I mean, you can talk about all day about, you know, it's the cool security architecture and protection you get from it and stuff like that. But I think the problem we've all had in the past as security leaders is that we often can kind of, a common sentiment, I guess, that was always had is the more flexibility a business adds, the more risk they take on. So security and security leaders ended up being known as the stick in the mud a lot of the time of the past, and maybe now in many organizations. because we were the ones saying, slow down, hang on, you can't just do that. That's going to add an enormous amount of risk and so on and so forth. But now with Zero Trust, we can kind of say, sure, let's help. Here's how we can help you do what you want to do, but securely, which is good for security teams' reputation and also the business itself. So some examples of, and so that comes under is secure business enablement is what I call it. So some examples are mergers and acquisitions. So they're always a bit of a security nightmare when a business goes through them, or security is often the afterthought. And that used to be because security would have to wait for networks to be connected, domains to be added, workstations to be imaged, and all sorts of other moving parts that had to go together before security could even get its tentacles in there to start protecting. And generally, once the paper's signed, anything that happens after that, security breach or anything like that, does become the responsibility of the parent company. So we can't really afford for security to be left so far last. And I don't know about others, but any mergers and acquisitions that I've worked for an organization and seen happen, it's wishful thinking to think that the technical integration is even going to be done in 1 year, let alone, you know, in a few months where you'd hope security would come in. So because we're not relying on those things anymore, like networks and domains and images of workstations and stuff, security really can come first, and we can just get that day zero security basically, which is the most important thing I think to happen when a merger or acquisition occurs. And I suppose that connects well to employee experience as well. You kind of think improved employee experience and security, those two things, it's like an oxymoron or something, they don't go together, right? But because we no longer assume a perimeter approach, users now get this thing where they can go work securely anywhere they like. Security isn't going to be the ones to tell them no. So both the employees and the business benefit from kind of productivity and flexibility enabled by the security program, which is quite good. Other than that, I would say team retention. So I think a common problem with cybersecurity teams, like everyone talks in the industry about burnout and all that sort of thing, and it's hard to hold on to talent. And I think that's because security teams can often get stuck. Now, most people who are in a security team are heavily experienced. They've probably been in IT and technology related roles for years before they finally moved over to cybersecurity. So they're really smart folks, right? And if you just tell them to work through patching and giant lists of vulnerabilities for months and months on end, they're not going to find that work very rewarding, and they're going to want to move on because they'll feel like they're spinning their wheels. Because what happens when you finally sort out the list of vulnerabilities and then 2 months go by, the list grows again, right? So it never gets better. Whereas generally any time I walk an organization through a zero trust strategy, we focus more on preventative controls rather than kind of corrective and detective. Like they're part of it, but they come later. And so I feel it refocuses security efforts on more enjoyable, kind of rewarding areas, you know, things like network segmentation, identity and access management, application control. And what those things do is all reduce the exposure of assets on the network, which means there's a lot less time spent on that more laborious kind of mind-numbing work, like the vulnerability management and patching, which I think are the key to kind of burning a team out. So, yeah, I could probably actually, you know, just share one last story of, you know, seeing this in action. That organization I worked for, where I said we kind of did zero trust by accident, I was both fortunate and unfortunate to be working for that organization when COVID hit, right? And it was an organization where a lot of people were required to be on site at all times. So it was heavily hit by this sudden, everybody has to work remotely type thing. And there were 10,000 employees, so it wasn't easy. Now, Every part of the business, not just technology and cybersecurity teams, but everywhere else had to scramble to think, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to make this business function remotely? And something that a lot of business leaders were doing is going through the business and consulting with specific departments about what was going to be required to make this work. And they were dreading coming to the cybersecurity team because they're like, that's the one person or people that are going to have a lot of bad things to say about this. But we were the ones that when they came to us, we said, yep, there's not really much for us left to do. Just give someone a laptop and go home and they'll remain protected the same way they are when they're on premise. And that was actually a highlight of my career because they went, what do you mean? Is that all we really need to do? And I said, yes, that's exactly right, because we don't rely on that to provide security. So it's a firsthand story there of how it can enable that business securely.
How good is that? You, I'm guessing people were like cheering you in the streets for that one, because I know there was other stories where organizations were not set up like that at all. And, you know, horror stories of like the scramble to try and even buy laptops because people were on, you know, these big desktop old towers kind of thing. And to your point, everything was set up kind of legacy architectures with, you know, perimeter, and you had to be there to be secure with no concept of ever working from home. So yeah, good to hear that one. If this framework's already in place, and for many organizations, right, that's part of the deal. You run some sort of a program, you get audited against some sort of CSF and, you know, ISO, you know, whatever one you want to think about, or sort of work against some kind of framework. Well, like, what are the benefits of kind of looking at ZT in those situations?
Yeah, I would say that, and that is a question I get asked reasonably often. We're already compliant with X, so why do we need zero trust? Or we need to comply with X, is zero trust going to solve that problem? And what I would say there is, and what I say to people when they ask as well, is that a lot of the frameworks in the industry are heavily compliance focused, which, you know, don't get me wrong, it's important for businesses and the cybersecurity function, but we can't, people often mistake compliance for security. Zero trust is, in my view, very focused on security, involved in controls and prevention. And if you look at some of the largest companies, or even the smaller ones getting breached around the world, every single one of them was compliant with any framework they could get their hands on. And yet it wasn't enough. Because I think an issue with some of those kind of well-known frameworks is that they need to apply very broadly and high level, which means some of the findings in the report are a little bit unclear with exactly what you need to do. And so with and taking that compliance-based only approach as well as a kind of unclear end goal, or at least how to get there, it can often be treated as a bit of a finding the path of least resistance just to tick a box, and an organization may be no more secure as a result, despite spending who knows how much money and time to become compliant and whatever they need to do. And I think with a ZT strategy, it should be heavily controls focused and look to kind of integrate technology in the right places, whilst also bolstering what you currently have. It's not about refreshing everything you have and buy all new stuff. You can definitely apply zero trust principles into a lot of what we already have as well. And that's certainly how we do zero trust strategies at Secure and how I do them with clients. A general motto that I always keep in mind when doing these is every recommendation in a zero trust strategy or approach needs to be clear, realistic, beneficial, and actionable. It can't be just pie in the sky that would be nice to have one day, but an organization can't hope to achieve. It has to be broken down into something digestible where they're like, reckon I can achieve that.
Yeah, I really like your point around the sort of idea of control existence versus effectiveness, and you know, I think that's a huge problem when you look at any framework. It's, you know, you talk to people and they sit through, you know, huge audits, produce documentation on what they've done, and you know, point to the box, but it doesn't say anything about configuration or effectiveness. And I think that's like such a spot on kind of observation. Here's another question. Like, I think when people think of things like zero trust, they probably think large organization. You know, this is something for, you know, the huge organizations, because it sounds like a lot to take on. But what's your take on that? Like, how does this fit in with other sized organizations or even small organizations?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I suppose to cover out of the way first, a huge chunk of zero trust strategies that I've done are on smaller organizations as well as a huge end of town. And you can always take different approaches for each one, but both can achieve what the appropriate level of zero trust for that type of organization. But I think what's most important to cover here is that zero trust isn't kind of an all or nothing approach. And it isn't a 100% set in stone outcome. So smaller organizations can still gain really large benefits, even if they only align with some areas of zero trust where it makes sense and they have budget and resourcing. And they can also still take on the zero trust mindset in everything they do as well, and gain benefits just in decision making and what they plan in their program of work. In fact, like, one of the things that when we were putting our zero trust kind of strategy framework type thing together, we saw that coming a mile away. There'd be heaps of organizations that aren't going to have the same level of capability and resourcing and whatnot as others. So with the way we did it was created multiple maturity levels. So like a maturity level 1, 2, 3 across 8 different pillars of Zero Trust. And that's kind of how you can make it digestible and doable. And obviously the difficulty in what needs to be achieved gets higher as you go up towards level 3. But an organization can take that sort of approach as well at finding out where it makes sense for them. And doing that. And some advice I gave the other night, actually, when I was doing a talk about Zero Trust in front of an audience was, if you don't have to do everything Zero Trust now and just kind of scrap everything you've got. What you can look at in terms of thinking, okay, where should it make sense for me to do Zero Trust? Look at your entire cybersecurity posture, which any security leader will know very well in their organization. And what they will know more than anything is their weak spots. Those spots that have been left behind because they've been neglected for, you know, various reasons. That is the area that you should focus on first and think about how you can do a Zero Trust aligned approach there. An example is if a organization had very good identity practices, they were managing the people security very well, and they were doing really well with things like endpoint security and stuff like that, but they know for a fact that they've left their network very flat internally. Well, if they're already doing okay with the others, even if they're not fully aligned with Zero Trust, but their network is in a terrible state, then that's an area that they can go, all right, well, how do I take a Zero Trust approach? And do I need technology to help me take that approach inside my networks? Because as far as I'm concerned, even if someone spends 6 months working on an area in their business to align with Zero Trust where they were very weak beforehand, that's going to add way more value to the overall cybersecurity program rather than trying to improve areas that they're already 60-70% aligned with.
Yeah, it sort of leads to me, I think it's probably our last question, but you know, you guys do the practical side of this and you've sort of, I think, covered it softly there, but it'd be interesting to hear what's the practical approach. Like you and your team go in with Secure and you've got to sort of build a strategy for an organization. What does that actually look like, you know, time-wise, how long it takes? You know, what does that practically look like when you and your team go into an organization with Secure to kind of help with the ZT strategy?
Yeah, so I think we're in an advantageous position at Secure as well, because there's a lot of vendors and the like out there that offer some sort of kind of Zero Trust alignment or something like that. But the problem is that they're always inevitably going to have an agenda that, of course, their solution is what's going to be recommended to give you that better alignment with Zero Trust, right? And vendors also don't like probably going into an area where they're recommending other vendors, so to speak, unless there's specific partnerships and that in place. And sometimes as well, vendors won't go into that advisory realm. Like, the quote I like to use for this, which is kind of a bit of a joke, is that we all remember when we call up a financial institution and the first thing they say to you is, our information is general in nature and does not take into account your personal situation. And, you know, the list goes on and we all have to acknowledge that before we can proceed, right? That's, I think, what vendors are unfortunately in, that kind of situation where any information they give you outside of what they offer is general in nature. It doesn't really look at the personal situation of the organization. Yep. Whereas at Securo, we can kind of, because we're not tied to any specific vendors or technologies or anything like that, and we've got like that strategic sort of background, it's kind of the opposite to that. Our information is quite specific in nature and takes into account exactly an organization's personal situation. Our approach to Zero Trust, to kind of go back to answering your question, is we believe Zero Trust needs to be looked at holistically in an organization. And so we came up with 8 pillars of Zero Trust. And I do realize there's other approaches out there that maybe have a little bit less pillars and that sort of thing as well. But our pillars in our view are kind of people, identities, endpoints, networks, infrastructure, applications, data, and analytics. And then as I said before, there's those 3 maturity levels that an organization can choose to align with across any one of those pillars. Generally, we give everyone, just because an organization is small, it doesn't mean that they can't align with higher maturity levels, because it's actually a bit of a catch-22 where, yes, it may seem like a smaller organization has less capabilities, but they also have less complexity as well. And sometimes that is the blocker to being able to achieve high levels of security maturity, right? When you've got 50,000 users and who knows how many stakeholders to keep happy while you roll this stuff out, you may be able to achieve a heck of a lot less in your cybersecurity program versus someone that's got 500 staff and a couple of people in the security team driving this. And we see that over and over again. So generally what we'll do is kind of ask a series of questions. I think we got over 155 different controls. We take them through. And then there's yeses or nos as we work out from level one, two, or three across each one of those pillars. They get a feel along the way, and certainly we do as well, what will make the most sense to them. Because as we start to reach kind of the level three questions, they'll go, yes, we're not doing, nope, that doesn't sound like something we can do, and all that sort of thing. And then we help them decide on a future state as well, and then kind of give them a strategy that kind of will map them to whatever they've kind of wanted to align with. And generally, like, it's controls focused, right? So I believe that a zero trust strategy and would need to be quite practical and quite literal with what they need to do, right? Tell them exactly what they need to do. Don't give them a very airy recommendation like, asset, manage your assets. Like, what does that really mean, right? Tell them exactly what they should do. Suggest a technology if they don't know what to look for to help that kind of thing. And also suggest timelines. Another probably problem that I certainly received getting any kind of external reporting done when I was kind of on the customer side was that you get this giant report of recommendations and everything is high risk, and there's medium risk, and there's low risk. But what isn't made clear is if there's 50 high risk or critical things, are they actually critical? Because there's 50 of them. What's more critical than another? And so what we set out to do is specifically don't use that sort of terminology on a ZT strategy. And we go down the route of going timelines. What do you need to sort out before something else? So in the first, what's first of all quick wins? What can you do with what you currently have that isn't going to cause any issues in your business? It's just going to give you security for free, basically. And then start from what do you need to start looking at and sorting out in the next 0 to 6 months, 6 to 12, 12 to 18, and then 18 to 24. And so, generally it's a 2 to 2.5 year sort of roadmap that most organizations look through, just depending on how much they're lacking and what they're kind of aligning with.
Yeah, excellent. I love the practical approach. Lee, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm very glad we finally got to do this. It's taken a little while to line up, but very much appreciate your time today. And on behalf of the audience, thank you very, very much for your insights.
Thank you, Gar. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks, Lee, for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening to the Get Cyber Resilient podcast. Jump into our back catalog of episodes and like, subscribe, and please do leave us a review. For now, stay safe, and I look forward to catching you on the next episode.